Don't panic. Jack Mangan's deadpan is mostly harmless. I'm your host, Jack Mangan, aka Paranoid Android. My guest today is the esteemed Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And on this week's Deadpan, there will be less telling, more showing. More matter, less art. And now, to give you a break from my voice, let's play a promo. Tell us a little bit about the ADD cast.
Well, it's a freeform beer cast, kind of. Ooh, shiny. What's that?
Hey, put that down. You could break it.
Sorry, I just get sidetracked sometimes.
It's okay. Just tell us about the show.
Yeah, right. We talk about tech stuff, beer, philosophy, laundry, religion. Oh, and did you see that cool video with that Japanese girl folding t-shirt technique thing? It's like magic t-shirt origami. You pick it up and wham! Perfect t-shirt fold, which reminds me of this Voltron t-shirt I used to have. It's a funny story.
Do you have guests on the show?
Right, the show. You mean the Balticon podcast?
No, the ADD cast.
Yeah, we have lots of fun on the ADD cast. We talk about everything.
But you get sidetracked a lot.
No, we pretty much talk about tech stuff and, hey, is that one of those new Sony digital recorders? Let me see that.
No, not till we're done talking about the podcast.
Which podcast?
Oh, never mind.
Ooh, shiny.
The ADD cast. You never know quite what you're going to get, but it's always good.
www.addcast.net.
All right, you maggots, wipe that stupid grin off your faces and listen up. This is Deadpan.
So the stolen rap lyrics thing has gotten pretty popular. I got 6 contributions this week. I'm not going to play all 6 in this episode. Some of them will get pushed back to next week. But you know what? Keep them coming. It's great stuff, and I'm really glad to share them. Anyway, we're going to play a few on this episode, including this masterful double shot. Sucka MCs may sweat it, but if you don't like it, then you be illin'.
Greetings. I am the Computer King. With another stolen rap lyric. About a subject I'm very familiar with, being king. King of Rock, that is, by Run DMC. And now we got the knack to attract, our rhymes an aphrodisiac. We'll rain on your brain and rock your knot. When it comes to rock, give it all we've got. To BMCs, we got what it takes. Let the poppers pop and the breakers break. We're cool, cool cats, it's like that. That's the way it is, so stay the hell back. We're causing hard times for Sucka MCs, cause they don't make no songs like these. This is the Computer King, signing off.
This speech is my recital. I think it's very vital to rock
a rhyme that's right on time.
Here we go. It's tricky to rock a rhyme, to rock a rhyme that's right on time. It's tricky,
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 tricky.
It's tricky to rock a rhyme, to rock a rhyme that's right on time. It's tricky, 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 tricky. I met this little girlie. Her hair was kind of curly. Went to her house, busted out. I had to leave her early.
These girls are really sleazy. All they just say is please me. Or spend some time and rock a rhyme. I say it's not that easy.
It's tricky to rock a rhyme, to rock a rhyme that's right on time.
It's tricky. How is it, Alvy?
Tricky.
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 Tricky. Tricky.
It's tricky to rock a rhyme, to rock a rhyme that's right on time.
It's tricky.
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 Tricky. Tricky. Tricky. Tricky.
Word.
Well, I think that's a deadpan first. Thanks very much to Alv DMC and Jam Master Jeremy, a.k.a. Alvy from Boulder and Jeremy from Seattle for that. Very nicely done. And before that, we had the masterful mic presence of the Computer King, who I have a feeling we'll hear from again before this episode is out. Alright, I got a quick note from Chris Fisher herself on that cool thing that I've been alluding to for the past couple of weeks now. She's actually come up with a cool way for me to procrastinate even further, which always scores many points with me. So listen up.
Telling the Deadpanites about that really cool favor. Glad you like it, but just to string this out a little longer and raise the atmosphere of anticipation, I have composed a multiple-choice test that includes a highly exaggerated version of the actual favor. But, my fellow Deadpanites, which is it? A. I'll be cosplaying as Major Makoto at this year's Anime Overdose, yes, in the battle bikini, and I'll be promoting Spherical Tomy on CD for $5 a pop. B. I'll be anteing up a digital alteration photo package as a prize for a potosphere-wide contest to promote Jack's upcoming patio book, Dirk Moonfire and the Nefarious Space Women. See my photo page at gettingby.net, or go to the About page and click to see some of the other digital alteration work I've done. C. I'm translating Spherical Tomy into Spanish and working with Jack on re-recording it for international release. D. I'm coordinating my webcomic contacts to produce a graphic novel version of Dirk Moonfire and the Nefarious Space Women. I'm hosting it on my site, www.gettingby.net, where I had hosted my old and discontinued comic, Getting By Comics, a story of grad school, retail, and some very odd neighbors. E. All of the above over the course of the next year and a half. F. You are now feeling curious, very curious. You feel excited and will jot down a note to recommend the Adult Space Child-Free podcast to all of your non-parent friends. You want to convert last year's portrait into a sci-fi or anime-themed digital art creation. You will visit www.gettingby.net. When I snap my fingers, you will wake up and immediately visit www.gettingby.net. Well, Jack, is it time to spill the beans? The correct answer is a much diminished version of D.
Wait, the answer was D? All right, I guess I need to talk to Chris Fisher. Must talk to Chris Fisher. Must go to gettingby.net. Okay, animal, do your thing.
All right, Deadpan listeners, my goal here for this interview is not to entertain or inform, just not to sound like an idiot. My guest is Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's author of numerous books on astrophysics, including The Forthcoming Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. He holds the Frederick P. Rose Directorship at the Hayden Planetarium. He's been appointed 2 times by the President to commissions on space studies and policies. He has an asteroid named after him. He's a graduate of Harvard and Columbia. He's done scores of interviews on TV and all forms of media. He's hosted the recent Nova PBS miniseries Origins. Though he probably brags most to his friends that he was voted Sexiest Astrophysicist Alive by People magazine in 2000. Welcome, and thank you very much for being on the show, Dr. Tyson.
Well, thanks for having me. No, I don't ever mention that. Okay. People magazine. I want to be respected for my mind.
Exactly, right. Right, we're not just pieces of meat around here, right? So, after that long intro, though, there's really no time left for the interview, though. So, no, I'm just kidding. Actually, that didn't even touch all of it. But now you have a really fascinating story, you know, getting to where you are. And I usually try to ask my guests about their past, present, and future. So feel free, please, to just tell us a little bit about your past and, you know, where you come from and how you got where you are.
I was born and raised in New York City, in the Bronx, to be precise. Even went to the Bronx High School of Science, which were some of my most formative years. But I've known for most of my life that the universe was where I wanted to land. And so I didn't realize at the time that to know this early on, like from age 9, creates, it enables a level of focus and establishing a trajectory for one's life that many people don't get to invoke until much later, you know, possibly when they get to college or even after that. So I never took any of that for granted, knowing how deeply engaged I was by the cosmos. And all of that was started by a first trip to the local planetarium, which in New York is the Hayden Planetarium. And I've never been the same since. Like, I've been starstruck, if you will. And so ever since then, I've, you know, went on to major in physics in college and got a PhD in astrophysics. And now I do research here in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History. And I also serve as director of the planetarium. So all that just keeps me off the streets.
That is truly unique, and it's really, I guess I'm not sure the right word is. It's really special to be able to do to find your focus at 9 and really realize it. At a pretty young age, too.
Like I said, I didn't know at the time. It took me a few years to realize that that was rare, And to this day, I sort of respect those who are still trying to find themselves at any age, and I try to do all I can to help focus that.
Okay. And now you can please tell me as little or as much as you want about the racial factors, and please tell me if I'm a jerk for bringing it up. I mean, if there was ever an issue for you, you know, being African-American in your position growing up, I understand that you've touched on this a little bit in your work, if people have treated you unfairly or if you've ever been...
Oh, I see.
If that's ever had an effect.
I mean, it's a daily thing, practically. But you'd be dead if you paused and reflected on that every single day that it happened. So just don't. My stories are not different from what you might hear from any Black American male that you might meet. They're the same. You get followed by security and department stores. The police stop you for no reason. This just happens. It just goes on. And so I don't even dwell on it. And to the extent that it is interesting for a listener to hear, then one should know that, no, we don't live in a country that has yet achieved equal opportunity. And although my stories are, of course, tamer than those that my parents told, given that I grew up in Second World War era, so the 30s, 40s, 50s, that they were, you know, witnesses of and participants in the civil rights movement, much of which happened before I really came online. So, no, my stories don't compare to those, but they're there. People, you know, when I was in high school, fully ready, willing, and able to join the physics club, their professors and classmates and say, oh, you should do athletics, you know. And so there was this urge, a push even, to promote people's expectations of who and what I should be. And so my life ended up becoming, for the most part, a path of most resistance, because the path I chose was not the path that society had established for me. And without my lifelong interest in the universe to draw from which I can draw energy to survive these assaults, I don't know where I'd be today. So I just kept working at it. And you know, fortunately, the scientific community, while it's not, you know, it's not without its problems and challenges, there's a greater hope and expectation that people are treated fairly within it, because all they judge you on is your work. Mm-hmm. Is it a correct understanding of the universe or not? And that transcends age, race, gender, religion. It's just, did it work? Does the model work? Is the theory accurate? Bada bing. You know, there comes the recognition. And especially since when you publish in journals, there's not a picture of yourself next to your research article. It's not like the commentators in magazines or newspapers where you got your smiley picture next to it. And I wonder why. You know, am I going to think differently about what you've written because of what you look like? Should I or should I not? Well, at least in science, there's the premise that it's separate from that. And like I said, while science is not without some ugly past, I'm happy to say that by and large, it's the paths of science, it's the methods and tools of science that in fact correct those problems that come about. So I'm here, you know, happily running the universe part of the American Museum of Natural History, and all is well in the universe, except for that asteroid that's headed our way.
Well, yeah, we just pretend that doesn't exist. Yeah, that's not your asteroid, right?
Oh no! The one that has my name on it—that's safely among brethren in the asteroid belt. And but there are others that are crossing Earth. I wouldn't want mine to be crossing Earth orbit. That'd be bad. They'd find that out headed towards Earth, and that, like, I'd get blamed, you know. So,
well, I mean, you know, you might as well.
So there was an episode of, I think I remember an episode of The Simpsons where Bart discovers a comet and it's headed towards Earth, and then they go blame him and burn down the observatory out of which it was discovered. I mean, you know, you never know how mobs will behave when confronted with that kind of information.
Right. Now you've touched on that a little bit too. What is the current climate in I don't know, the world or in America, of sort of the general populace and the mob, and I'm not, I don't specifically mean religion, but feel free to touch on that, versus science or in the relation to science. Is there a clash today? Is there a problem, or are things pretty smooth?
Well, there's always a clash. There's never a period where there's not a clash. So there people would pretend there isn't, mm-hmm. but if you really sort of part the curtains, it's going on all the time. It's been going on forever. You know, Galileo was perhaps the most visible example of that. The trial of Galileo.
Sure.
He was put on trial. By the way, he was kind of obnoxious at the time and embarrassed people in high position. So he was pompous, which didn't help matters because the people in power don't like being made fun of. But apart from that, if you read the transcripts, it's basic. The transcript doesn't say you're being put under house arrest because you made fun of me. it doesn't say that as written by the Pope. It says you were not teaching the word of the Bible, which says that Earth is in the center of all motion and da-di-da. And he, with his telescope, one of his own design, better than any that had come before, made it pretty clear that Earth was not the center of all motion. Earth went around the sun, as did the other planets, and the sun was more significant than the Earth. And this is one of many findings about the natural world that conflicted with the tenets of religion. It's been going on ever since. So, by the way, that conflict is not in the realm of the spiritual, if you will. It's in the realm of the natural world. So if you go to the Bible and extract what is, in your judgment, a prediction about how the physical world ought to be, history has shown that that just simply fails. It has failed every single time that's ever been attempted. And let me repeat that. It's, if you go to, it doesn't have to be the Bible, any religious text.
Sure.
If you go to such a text and by your reading of the text make some prediction about the natural world, some statement that we don't already know, and that your hope is then, or expectation is that it will come true. It has never come true. And what we found is that the methods and tools of science are vastly superior means of coming to understand how the physical universe works. And for those who hold their predictions of the Bible sacred, when they're confronted with what science finds about the world, then it becomes a problem. In fact, it only becomes a problem if the people are in positions of power, as what happened during the Inquisition.
Right.
When they're not in a position of power, then it just gets chalked up as a difference of worldview and people get on with life. But this is precisely what happened with the intelligent design conversation. It happened with Darwinian evolution beginning in 1859, continuing to this day. And eventually people kind of get over it. Like, you don't hear people saying, Earth is still the center of the universe. And you don't hear people saying that. But it took hundreds and hundreds of years for that to sort of work its way into the popular conscience. Now, that being said, there are religious scientists. Science is not all atheists. There are 40% of American scientists claim a personal God who listens to and responds to their prayers. So it's not a conflict between scientist atheists and religious believers. It's those scientists who do claim themselves to be religious are not getting their science from the Bible. They're getting their spirituality from the Bible. And they're relying on their God-given senses, if you will, to understand the world through the methods and tools that we invent. So for them, there's no conflict. The conflict is between those who want to get their science out of the Bible and the actual science that's going on right alongside it.
Yeah, it would seem to me that it's more about having a predetermined agenda before you even begin your introspection and your investigation, which science, obviously, that's one of the tenets, is that, you know, I understand that occasionally theorists will come up with a theory and they kind of do fall in love with it. But I mean, I've heard also that that's one of the rules of science is don't fall in love even with your own theories. That's
exactly right. That's a recipe for a bad cake. If you fall in love with, if you become attached to your theory, to your theory, mm-hmm. What happens is your brain starts playing tricks on you, and you start ignoring the data that conflict with your theory, and only recognizing the data that support it. And then you end up publishing papers, research papers, that are biased in ways that you might not even have been aware of because it was operating subliminally in the act of taking data. This is a well-documented phenomenon, and part of the methods and tools of science are to reduce that effect as much as possible. But if you don't even know that it can take place, as is true with much of the public who might not have the training that a scientist does, it can happen to the public all the time. And it happens in science less often. But the times that it does happen in science, that can be quite embarrassing, and in fact, it has ruined people's careers.
I see. Okay. Now,
they clutch to their idea even when data is flying in their face. And so what happens is people just move on. And those who are clutching to old ideas about how things were, they basically just get old and die, and that's the way they get removed from the map.
I see. Yeah, it is almost sort of Darwinian, almost, is it? They've proven that they're not the fittest.
I thought of it that way, but yeah, I mean, that, sure, take it.
Okay, we're going to take about a 3.5-minute pause from the Neil deGrasse Tyson interview for Mark Forman to contribute an earbud segment. That's Mark Forman, the Brooklyn blues man.
You know, I was talking to Jack Mangan the other day, and he was encouraging me to do an earbuds. And I kind of had an idea what an earbuds was, since there's only one done prior to me doing this one, but kind of didn't really pay a lot of attention. I mean, Matt Mangan was talking about some stuff, and I wanted Jack to clarify what it was that he had in mind an earbud should be, and he did. And so I thought a pretty good idea. And as soon as he made it a little bit more clear, this is what I flashed on. I don't know how many of you saw the movie High Fidelity, and in Jack's case, read the book, and he was emphatic about how great the book was. Well, I haven't read the book yet, but after Jack made a big deal about it, I will. Because if Jack thinks it's that great, I'm sure it is. I will tell you, one of the things got out of the movie, in a lot of ways, it kind of reminded me of myself as a kid. I did work in a record store, strangely enough, but not in the record department. I was over in audio. But I'd been in many record stores with a lot of really fanatical and arrogant music clerks like that, and I could go toe-to-toe with them because I was like the one customer friend of theirs, the black guy that was really hip and knew his stuff. So the one moment or two that I had in there that really, really stood out to me was that when the owner, who was played by, John Cusack, had decided to go for the juggler, to come in with the killer blow, what everyone will just, you know, have to buy, is when he put on the song by the Beta Band, Dry the Rain. And it was such a strong connection because that's one of those magical songs. Like, the first time I heard it, it was like, who is that? The same reaction they had in the movie. People just kind of start grooving to it and tapping their feet and bobbing their heads and turning around and smiling like, who is that? And I mean, it was such a magic moment because it was like, yeah, that's exactly the response that it invoked within me. And the other one that was really cool was the character that's played by Todd Louisa, the kind of geeky guy. I was kind of quiet, was kind of bullied a little bit by Jack Black's character when he met his soon-to-be girlfriend, and he was talking about how Green Day was influenced by Stiff Little Fingers. Now, Stiff Little Fingers is a band when I heard back when I was in college. They're a band from Northern Ireland, and I mean, I heard about them, and the first time I put that record on, I heard Turn of Ulster, I thought I would explode. It was just the energy, the intensity, the passion was just, you know, so much. So to hear two of those bands, and in particular one of those songs, be mentioned in that movie like that, which was a totally cool movie overall anyhow, was just like, you know, the ultimate for me. So I guess that's my earbuds memory or earbuds thingy for the day. Hope you enjoy it.
Jack Mangan's Deadpan. The coolest thing to hit your computer since you spilled that cold soda last week.
Now, tell me some theories that you're in love with right now. If there's anything exciting to you right now that you think is, I guess I worded that very badly, but I guess tell me maybe some of the recent theories put forth and recent discoveries and ideas that you find really exciting in science right now, of your own and of your colleagues.
Well, I would say it's not so much emergent theories, but efforts to make discoveries. Let's put it that way. That's a more accurate way to put it. I'm completely jazzed by the prospect that we might find life in places other than Earth. And how could you not be,
right,
when you think about it? It's, you know, life is, the formation of life remains one of the great scientific frontiers. And it's not just a biological frontier, it's a chemistry frontier, it's an astrophysical frontier. Because the clues to understanding the formation of life may come to us from astrophysical objects. Because we can't roll back the clock on Earth and watch it happen. So we can make inferences around that time when inorganic matter becomes non-living organic matter becomes living organic matter. But we have this enormous universe that laid out in front of us where things are happening all the time. Planets are being formed. We can see systems at different stages of their formation and evolution that may tell us exactly what went on here on Earth. So I hope that happens in my lifetime, because that'll be an exciting day.
Sure, yeah. And it seems to me, and this may be my own naivety, but it seems that when I was growing up, seems maybe 20 years ago, that the scientific overall...
Well, still growing up, so don't just put it back then. You're still growing up.
That's a very good point, actually. But it seems that the scientific perspective was pretty pessimistic about the possibility of any life at all, no matter how we choose to stretch the definition, that there's no life at all in our solar system. But it seems like lately there's been some optimism that there may be something, in the moons of Jupiter. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent point to raise. One of the trends in science over time, no matter the field of science, is that we learned that our previous ideas were more narrow and more restrictive than was necessary, or than what was the truth of what the universe held. And so science is this eternal march of opening our eyes and ears and attention to what's going on in the universe. So in the case of the search for life, what we have found on Earth is that there are places where life thrives, and these places are such that they would kill us post-haste. I mean, no question about it. They're hot, they're high acid, they're high pressure, high temperature, cold temperature. We find bacteria that are hanging out there like it's their summer vacation. And there's it's new strains of bacteria. They're known as extremophiles, which is, of course, Latin for extreme lovers.
Right.
And they love extreme environments of every kind. And what that did was, well, biologists loved it because it further broadened the concepts of biodiversity. What it did for the astrophysicist, it said, well, hey, we've got an environment that's hot. We've got an environment that's radiation infested. We've got an environment just like that on another place. If life can survive that here on Earth, maybe life can survive that in these places of the solar system and beyond. So what it did was it increased the size of the catcher's mitt, or of the net that we're using to drag across the universe and see what places will reveal life and what places do not.
Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty good metaphor, too, about the net. Now, where do you think is the most likely right now?
Oh, my target place is Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, where Europa does not get heat from the sun. It gets heat from the gravity of Jupiter, and there's a tug of war between the gravity of Jupiter and other surrounding satellites. And in that tug of war, it stresses the physical body that is that moon, the moon Europa. Mm-hmm. And the ice that is on its surface, beneath that surface, that ice has melted. And we don't know how thick the ice is yet, but we're pretty certain there is an ocean of liquid water that's been ocean for billions of years. And all evidence points to life getting its good start here in the oceans on Earth. The waters are the most fertile places on the planet. So we've got people curious about whether life has formed on Europa in this environment far away from the sun. One might even say where the sun don't shine, deep beneath what might be a kilometer thick layer of ice. So I want to go ice fishing on Europa. cut a hole through, melt a hole through, however you want to get through, and drop a submersible camera, see if anything swims up to the lens and licks it.
Now, is there a plan for this fishing expedition any time in our lifetimes?
That's an excellent question. There were plans on the books that got delayed, and Europa remains on everyone's sights. You want to go and find a landing site first. So it would be a multi-tiered attack of Europa. But right now, there's nothing funded that will enable it. NASA has some other problems it's trying to resolve. So trying to get the manned program back online. And so, but people have not forgotten it, and it will not be forgotten.
Okay. And just to switch gears a little bit, since we're headed that far out into the solar system at this point. Now, as a science fiction author, I have a little bone to pick with you about you. You're trying to deplanetize Pluto.
Yeah.
I need that out there.
Started on it. You're going to get me started on it. There's no turning back, but go on.
No, no, go ahead. I'd love to hear. This actually I find very interesting, so please go on.
Well, what's your question about Pluto?
Well, just about Pluto, and there's the newest large object out there, which I know as some have said, yay, there's a 10th planet out there in the Kuiper Belt, and I hope I pronounced that correctly.
But, Kuiper Belt is fine.
Now, why, I guess tell my listeners and me, you know, I guess sum up as, go into as much detail or as little detail as you want about why Pluto and that new 10th object are not planets.
Well, let's back up for a moment. The word planet actually has no formal definition. So to argue whether it is a planet or is not grounded in either lexicography or science right now. It's just not. The last time the word planet had an unambiguous definition was in ancient Greece, where the word planetes, from which we get our English word planet, just simply meant wanderer. And wanderer, when they looked up into the night sky, they found seven objects that wandered from night to night against the background stars or against the background sky. Mm-hmm. And those seven objects were Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. If you define planet as moving against the background sky, that is an unambiguous definition giving you those seven objects. The rest of the objects, the stars, in a human lifetime do not noticeably move against their background. So, that was it until Copernicus put the Sun in the middle of the known universe and not the Earth. That put Earth on equal ranks with these other objects that we had previously called planets. The Moon then goes around the Earth, subservient to Earth. So the Moon drops out of the list. We join the list. The Sun leaves the list. And then, so what is planet now? Well, it's just something that goes around the Sun? Well, okay, let's do that. Then in 1800, we found some stuff that went around the Sun in orbit between Mars and Jupiter. Everyone got excited. They found a bunch of objects. In fact, in 1830, if you looked at textbooks back then, they were boasting of the 12 planets of the solar system. Turns out, you know, five of them are what we now today called asteroids. But they didn't know it at the time that they had discovered a whole new swath of real estate in the solar system, a whole new category of object that were more like each other than any one of them were like anything else. It took a few years to shake it out of their system. Then they realized we can't keep calling these planets because they're completely different species from what we now hold to be a planet. So they did the right thing and reclassified them into another category, what, like I said, what we today called asteroids. Mm-hmm. So Pluto is similar in this. It was discovered in 1930, and everyone was jazzed about it. An American discovered it, so people got a little jingoistic about it. But fine. There's a new planet. And then they assumed it was big, like the size of Uranus or Neptune. Early textbooks give a size that's that high. Here's the brain kicking in, right? Because you want it to be something. The data, you know, you ignore the data that says it's small and only believe the data that say it's large when there's large uncertainty in the measurement to begin with. And all of a sudden, you think you have a big planet on your hands. And over the years, as measurements got better and better and better, people realized that this thing is not even the size of our moon. Earth's moon. And in fact, there are five moons in the solar system bigger than Pluto. Pluto's made of mostly ice, we later learned. If you brought Pluto to where Earth is right now, the heat from the sun would evaporate its gases and it would grow a tail. We've got words for icy bodies that have tails. They're called comets. Now, Pluto didn't, we weren't going to make a class of one because that just doesn't make any sense. And in the 1990s, other objects were discovered in the outer solar system that had similar orbits to Pluto, where they had similar similar ingredients to Pluto. They were mostly ice by volume. And we realized, hey, Pluto was simply the largest member of a new swath of real estate in the solar system, a new place, a new category of object now known as the Kuiper Belt. So all we did here at the American Museum of Natural History was put Pluto among its newfound family and friends, where it's now one of the largest members. It's like the king of the comet, instead of being the puniest planet. I think it's happier there, actually. And in fact, the word planet has lost its meaning. It never really had a meaning after Copernicus. So the inner terrestrials, the Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, have more in common with each other than any one of them have with anything else in the solar system. So they form a natural family unit. And the Jovian objects, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they form a family more alike to each other than they are to anything else. So here in our exhibitry, we treat the solar system as a collection of as families of objects, not the enumeration of what people are calling planets. There's no science in that. You have elementary school teachers giving exams saying, what is the name of the fifth planet from the sun? There's no science in that. There's science in what do the Jovian planets have in common? They're large, they're low density, they have rings, they have many moons. There's understanding of the solar system embedded within that. So we take what we believe is the scientific as well as the pedagogical high road by presenting the solar system in a way that leaves you with a deeper understanding of how the solar system is put together.
Wow, very nice. Well, I mean, that still goes against what I want to think, so I'm going to continue to think of it the way I think of it.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
And there's the abrupt end to the interview. It's not that he was being rude. He had to go, and I just edited out the parts of me saying, oh, I need to let you go, and him saying, yeah, you know, because it's not really great interview stuff. But thank you very much to Dr. Tyson for being on The Deadpan. All right, we're at about 37 minutes. Let's see how much more we can squeeze into the final 10. I'm afraid after that great highbrow interview, it's all downhill from here. And the perfect way to start the descent is a segment I call Highbrow Lowbrow. If you're unfamiliar, Highbrow Lowbrow is like washing down your beluga caviar with a slug of Mad Dog 2020. It's like the poetry of John Keats, as read by Pauly Shore. Did you know I once hosted a pilot episode for a Jerry Springer type of talk show? I thought it would make an appropriate highbrow lowbrow. As you'll soon figure out, this was a long time ago. Upon this afternoon's globe stage, proffer thine eyes and senses to my guest Othello the Moor. Othello, tell us about thine strumpet wife Desdemona.
Nay, do not speak it. Such fires of passion and anger doth her name burn upon my soul. She hath lain with he whom I name my friend and digital wristwatch, Cassio.
Cometh Cassio now, a cheap plastic electronic keyboard clutched to his breast. Did he make Desdemona Mona?
Cassio, how couldst thee stab thy brother so and keep time with my wife? She wore thee upon her wrist. Do you deny this?
I did thee no such offense, my lord. I cherish you above all my friends and would ne'er do thee such injury.
Cracker, please.
Bring us now to the stage the woman at this matter's heart, or perhaps some other organ, be a more appropriate description. Nevertheless, Othello's untrusted wife, enter now. Welcome the fair Desdemona.
Desdemona, I loved thee more than the sum of all things of Eden assembled. Let the sun freeze in her ether, the moon crack and fall in pieces to the earth, but ne'er let my love for thee be betrayed. Bitch, how could you?
You know, we had Iago's wife on our last play. It was the episode, The Play Is Always Sweating My Fine Ass. She confessed that her husband hath spread all these untruths upon which you dwelleth. 'Tis Iago who hath spread these falsehoods and slandered all of our names.
Nay, I believe it not. Iago, my homie.
Well, allow Iago to set his foot and reputation upon this globe stage. Bald security guy, summon him forth.
Iago, thou villain!
Iago, speaketh true.
Didst thee spread falsehoods about Cassio on mine fair wife?
Of course. I hate you for no real reason.
Piece of
final thoughts. I'll look on the tragic loading of this stage. Myself will straight to syndication, and with heavy heart, share this tale's relation. Warning, F-word dead ahead.
Hey, Deadpan, it's Andrea. I hope you're doing good. I'm calling a couple things. First of all, I purchased one copy of the Amityville House of Pancakes from Amazon. So hopefully I will be getting that soon and reading that. The other reason I called was because it's Tuesday, and on Tuesdays, you know, they have the new music Tuesdays on iTunes. So I bought some new stuff, and I was thinking, well, I'll just call and do one of those earbud things. So let's see, what am I listening to? Well, I'm really digging the Gnarls Barkley CD. It's pretty fucking cool. I've got the new Ice Cube album, and I don't know about that one yet. There's a couple good things on it, but I'm not totally sold. Obviously, I'm still listening to, still obsessed with the Twilight Singers, of course. And Massive Attack. They put out like a collection of Massive Attack, which I have all their stuff anyway, but it's made me, inspired me to re-listen to them, and they're just a really fucking cool band. Some new stuff I got today, Sonic Youth. They have a rather ripped CD, which is kind of mellow. It's kind of cool. I haven't finished listening to it yet, but I'm kind of busy today. Pet Shop Boys had a new one, Fundamental. And there's a guy, Ulrich Strauss. He's an electronic guy. I hope I pronounced that right. He's really cool. They have a new EP of his. His stuff is really awesome. You should check him out. And what else is there? Oh, they re-released POD's Brown album. I don't know if you were a fan of that, but it's just kind of cool to see that again. I might have to pull that out and listen to it. I guess that's it. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
This is Matt Mango. Got a new sample of music here for you. For Jack Mangan's Deadpan. Earbuds.
Hey, Jack and Debbie. I hope you're having an excellent edition of the Dead Pound Podcast. This is Paul Fisher from the ADD Cast and the Balticon Podcast at addcast.net and balticonpodcast.org. I'm so enthralled and grateful that you would let us participate in Dirk Moonfire, and so I'm returning the favor by giving you some of my stolen rap lyrics. Me, I'm going old school and white bread. Maybe that's just old prep school. See if you can tell what I'm singing. Fab Five Freddy told me everybody's high. DJ's spinning are saving my mind. Flash is fast, flash is cool. Francois Safaz, flash has no do. And you don't stop, sure shot, go out to the parking lot. And you get in your car and you drive real far. And you drive all night and you see a light. And it comes right down and it lands on the ground. And out comes a man from Mars. And you try to run, but he's got a gun. And he shoots you dead and he eats your head. And now you're in the man from Mars. You go out at night eating cars. You eat Cadillacs, Lincolns too, Mercurys, and Subaru. And you don't stop. You keep on eating cars.
That one is as white bread as it gets. That was Rapture by Blondie, circa, 1970 Disco Land or something. Anyway, it's old. Hope you like it. And keep the deadpan coming. I'm digging them all.
Jack, this is Danny in NC with another stolen hip-hop lyric. This is from Khalees, and the name of the song is In Public. He was next to me. Our flight was supposed to leave around 2:53. All I wanted to see is what he would do if I dropped down to my knees. I want to play a game. Is someone coming? It don't matter just the same. Try something fun with me. Let's take our clothes off all over the balcony. Let's get it on in public. Just let it go. I promise that you'll love it. Ooh, Daddy, don't you want to be my subject? Ooh, let's get it on in public.
Thanks and kudos to Danny and Paul, representing Eastside. So that does it for another edition of The Deadpan. Thank you for listening, and if you just tuned in to hear Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, then I apologize if it got too strange or intense for you here at the end. But hey, it's all fun, it's all deadpan. If you want to call me, the voicemail number is 206-350-TOMI, that's 206-350-8664. If you want to give me money, that would be great. The button is on the sidebar at www.jackmangan.com. If you sent me something and you didn't hear it this week, then a couple of things. It will probably get played next week. Feel free to send me an email and harass me about it. If your attachment was bigger than 10 megabytes, I might not have gotten it. So definitely feel free to send me an email and talk to me about it. Gonna leave off with a piece of music that's all me, just me. It's called Exhumed. Named for the word in Shakespeare plays when everyone departs the stage. So listen, enjoy, and I'll catch you next week on The Deadpan. I'll see you guys in the comments. And now, Exhumed.
I can't stand the sight of you. I can't stand the sight of you. I can't stand the sight of you. I can't stand the sight of you.
No, that's not it.